Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Generation of Redemption. You're listening to Isaac Baton's wonderful song, Generation of Redemption, from his Generation Redemption album. And this is Blog Talk Radio. You're now tuned into our class in particular within the blogtalkradio.com network is Soul Class 482, Secular by Design, Part 39. And we're live because we're staying alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. Blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. We're now broadcasting on May 19th, 2015, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls. Actually, it's 9.02 a.m., program content will focus on reading from a portion from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which can be purchased by at the following link, www.amazon.com/secular-design-philosophy-noahide-observances/dp/09779-88546. Our call-in number in this next 26 minutes, a little bit more than that as well, will be 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless you and your families and friends and loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. Let's just turn down the music. Sorry, Rev. Isaac. Hi. And this is the Generation of Redemption. And joining me right now is the author of the book Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, and all-around nice guy, Alan Cecil. Good morning, sir.
How do you do? Everything going all right?
Baruch Hashem. We also have Rambam, teacher, student, activist, and disseminator of the teachings of Rambam, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Boker Tov, Alan. Boker Tov, Don.
Boker Tov. Now, gentlemen, before we start, I just want to mention, you know, Blessed, it was one of my concerns in doing a show like this, because I do like to stay positive, is that, you know, there is a lot of criticism for Western philosophy. Of course, there's some good things that can be called out of it. However, at the end of the book, I want to start reading as well, one commandment at a time, because Alan did a great service for all of mankind, first of all, by writing this book, and also in quoting from a classic work in Jewish literature, in Hebrew-Jewish literature, in Torah-Jewish-Hebrew literature, called Sefer Chinuch, which can be translated as the Book of Education, or as the Book of Dedication. And at the end of the program, we're going to read, because many people think the Seven Commandments are just a flippant way of throwing out certain precepts to the nations of the world, and I've even heard Christian theologians and people who want to replace the Torah with their own idea of how things should go in the world, spiritually and theologically, and also as well as how the world should be run physically. And this enumeration, this brilliant enumeration, as Alan did, of this Sefer Chinuch, will put that to rest forever, because actually, just as the Ten Commandments, which we'll be celebrating, the giving of the Ten Commandments for the 3,328th time, this coming Sunday and Monday here in the West, and only on Sunday in the land of Israel, actually are branched out to 613 total commandments, and the seven universal commandments actually branch out, according to this delineation, to 209. So I just wanted to throw that out to you. Also, I just want to mention as well that we're going to hopefully be archiving this program through a free app, which I want to actively promote. It's called J-App, J-APP.me. And you just have to sign up for free, and you can get programs like this in an archive version. If you have a smartphone, if you have iTunes, if you have Google Play, if you have the App Store, you can access this type of information for free, and you can share it with friends and review the type of information I think is so important to be spread out through the creation to each and every nation in this generation. With that being said, just one more thing. Don't want to toot my own horn, but we did, in fact, give a class this past Sunday in Crown Heights at 1433 Beit Mazel, which is run by Rav Isaac Batona, whose music we heard at the beginning of the program, and hopefully we'll have another class in about 3 weeks. We had 7 participants, and we had Ben Noah Scala, Ron Noah, we had Booker T. Washington, Business League President Kartrell Gore, who is not only a man of many degrees, he's also a truant officer in the New York City public school system. We had Ruti Abramowitz, a Torah activist in the New York City area. We also had Yiska Levinson, who is also involved in helping Jews, especially those Jews of Sephardic ancestry and Gentiles who are considering of whether they should convert back to becoming Jews proper, or should they satiate themselves with the 7 Noahide commandments. And I brought up Alan's book as part of the class, and hopefully we're going to integrate the book into future classes, and hopefully if Alan will be available, we can have him call into the class, and he also can share his insights, because his insights are very fascinating. And if we can, in fact, arrange for a dial-in number where people can listen in to the class via telephone, because it won't be in my apartment with the computer as we normally do to Soul Talk Radio, Soul Class Radio, then we can make this more accessible to more human beings. And again, then hopefully we'll be able to upload everything up into JApp. So, gentlemen, excuse me for speaking so much, but I thought this was all very pertinent information. So now we're turning to page 73, and we're painting basically, or we're constructing the border in which we can understand someone who is unfortunately in the category of a Torah-hating author, Richard Dawkins, where he spent his formative years basically in Kenya. So reading from the top of page 73, to give us an understanding of what type of environment Richard Dawkins grew up in, and yet he is so anti-Torah, where the British had basically internalized in some way the enlightened philosophy of John Stuart Miller to slaughter way, way too many Africans in the country of Kenya. So as the British took on the white man's burden in Kenya, many of the Kikuyu, which was a tribe in Africa, in Kenya, decided they had enough of British imperialism and decided to fight for their land, and many secretly took the Mau Mau Oath, which revolved around two important aspects that Americans should recognize as certain unalienable rights, land and freedom. The Mau Mau were simply the Kikuyu who had armed themselves with machetes and clubs against the better armed and organized British veterans of the Second World War. And after hacking a few white settlers to pieces, the rebellion was quickly put down by the British. The disparity in death is striking. One official data, the Mau Mau, or Africans so described, lost 12,590 in action by hanging over the 4 most active years of war. 164 troops or police died in that period, most of them Africans. Mau Mau killed 1,880 civilians, nearly a third of them KG, but all but 58 of them black. Elkin's numbers of those killed was that officially fewer than 100 Europeans, including settlers, were killed, and some 1,800 loyalists died at the hands of the Mau Mau. In contrast, the British reported that more than 11,000 were killed in action. Though the empirical and demographic evidence I unearthed calls into serious question the validity of this figure, I now believe that there was in late colonial Kenya a murderous campaign to eliminate Kikuyu people, a campaign that left tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands dead. So this is what is most disturbing to me, Alan, is that right after World War II, as you described in the book, it's almost like the British were taking over the role that the Nazis had tried to carry out in before and during World War II of genocide, not only against the Jewish people, but against anyone who went against them. And it seemed like the British, although they felt their struggle was righteous against the Nazis, kind of like took up the baton to bring about this type of disastrous, murderous attitudes toward the Kikuyu. And in fact, Elkins revealed that the British actually destroyed the files of their treatment of Kikuyu, which in fact rivaled the Nazi excesses of the Holocaust, if in spirit, if not in size. And that's your quoting from this would be from Carolyn Elkins' Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. Alan?
Yeah, well, it just goes to show that all Vesuvian societies pretty much operate in the same way. Some are more have greater atrocities than others, but they all commit atrocities. I mean, even America, we did the same thing with Native Americans, the Indians.
Right, right.
Our campaign of ethnic cleansing. This is how Vesuvian regimes operate. And Dawkins, you know, in his criticism of religion and the Torah, you know, he fails to understand that not only did his British society commit these atrocities, his family was directly involved in it.
Mm. And I just want to clarify, you, Blessed Souls, when Alan mentioned Vesuvian societies, we're talking about those who adhere to the principles of the twin brother of Jacob, Israel, Yaakov Israel, Esau, who believed in the primacy of physicality to the exclusion of pursuing a higher pursuit, and he saw a contradiction between spirituality and physicality, which then manifested into basically a lawless, you know, winner-take-all, you know, only survival of the fittest type of mentality, which eventually, unfortunately, morphed into the ancient Greek and Roman cultures. Dennis?
Well, the sages identified Esau with Rome.
Right. And I know that the I read in one book, Torah book, is that the English were actually not only conquered by Rome early on in their history, but actually they had enlisted soldiers from England to actually participate. There were early on Britons who were involved in the attack and even the destruction of the Second Temple. So the British have always had a certain hostility, in that we even saw it in the last 100 years, where they were not too happy that the Jews were fighting against them to try to take back the sovereignty of the land of Israel. And they responded by not only fighting against the Jews and imprisoning the Jews and preventing Jews from immigrating to Israel after World War II, they actually were involved in arming the Arabs. So they basically were flaming the fuel of enmity between two cousins, two different tribes, the Israeli tribes and the Arabic tribes. Dennis?
Yes, throughout history we have extremism to the point that the extremism is more important than where it came from. In other words, most of these people go back to ancient times or a derivative of ancient times, but they forget that the basis for all the ancient ideas was peace and love. However, they think that extremism is justification for killing. Now, you may want to say, well, it's murder, killing. I'm just calling it the general idea of killing. So in view of the fact that they considered themselves, as you said, righteous, they now had the authority to get rid of those people who were non-righteous. In whose opinion? Their opinion. And their opinion was the main one. So therefore, anybody else was fair game to be killed. So you'd say, gee whiz, why would they do that? Well, they didn't want to say it was a war. They wanted to say that these people are dangerous, that they're spreading poison and they're harming righteous people. So based on that, they felt justified. On whose basis? Their viewpoint. So merrily they went about, periodically killing people. And it's been practiced all over the world by different types of people. And why? Because there's a difference. And if you're not of their ilk, then you're different. If you're different, there must be something wrong with you. So the justification goes on and on. It's a little stupid, but humans use it all the time.
True. At the end of page 74, as we conclude the historical tragic episodes which transpired in the after World War II in Kenya, Alan brings down that there was actually a master of disinformation. His name was Alan Lennox Boyd, who was appointed colonial secretary to Kenya in 1954, a master of disinformation with a high sense of authoritarian righteousness. To cover up for the atrocities that had transpired upon the Kenyan people, Lennox Boyd did what he did best. He obfuscated the facts, skirted the issues, and lied. He shrouded violence and torture in the camps inside the garment of Britain's civilizing mission. Now, these noble lies can only be explained in terms of British morality, the same morality the British exhibited in Tasmania, in Gurkha, and in Ireland during the Irish potato famine. And I also want to add the slave trade, which they helped spur on, as well, of course, as I just mentioned, how they, when they were the ruling country in the land of Israel during the after World War I up until 1947, 1948, where again their British morality led to a lot of bloodshed on the side of themselves, unfortunately, as well as for Jews as well as Arabs. And it's within the brutal environment of Kenya, as according to the colonization efforts of the British, where the Torah-hating author Richard Dawkins spent his formative years. He was born in Nairobi in 1941. Nairobi is in Kenya, where he lived there until 1949. Now, Dawkins, as Alan went on to describe, is a descendant of upper-middle-class landed gentry and a direct descendant of the Clinton family who held the earldom of Lincoln. Dawkins spent his early childhood years in the imperialist British enclaves of Kenya, where, quote, beyond such gentrified leisure, these privileged men and women live an absolutely hedonistic lifestyle filled with sex, drugs, drink, and dance, followed by more of the same. And that was brought down in Elkin's book, Imperial Reckoning, page 11. It is hard to imagine that Dawkins' formative years spent in the hedonistic and racist atmosphere of British-controlled Kenya did not have an effect on his mores and values. And I want to add as well, probably his memes as well, M-E-M-E-S. Even if Dawkins did not witness the brutality and immorality firsthand, he certainly was exposed to the prevailing British attitudes towards their ethnicity, challenging subjects, the same attitudes the British displayed in Ireland, India, Australia, and South Africa. What is particularly ironic, if ironic is the correct word, is that one of the major criticisms of Dawkins' levies against the Jews is the quote-unquote ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses, brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for its bloody massacres, its records, and xenophobic relish with which it does so. And that's quoting from Dawkins' book, The Blank Delusion, 280. I really think the book should be titled The Dawkins Delusion. What Dawkins misses is, as usual, the why question. The Canaanites were the most hedonistic and unjust people in that time, and the only way to eradicate the memes, the memes that they had created and spread, was to eradicate the source, the Canaanites themselves. Dawkins' children do not think, by the way, that the God character in the story nursed any doubts or scruples about the massacres and genocides that accompanied the seizing of the Holy Land. And as brought down by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch in the Hirsch Chumash, the land of Canaan at the time was occupied by the descendants of Ham, the most corrupt tribe among the Noahides. Now, I do want to inject this because it is very, very important from the oral Torah tradition, where you read openly in Scripture, blessed souls, that the Canaanites, the Jews, the Israelites were told to eradicate them. It was not without a pre-existing attempt to, first of all, offer them peace, and to offer them the option of subduing themselves or elevating themselves really to the fulfillment of the 7 9 commandments, where they would work alongside the Israelites in the settling of the land. They were also given the option of leaving the land if they wish. In fact, one of the 7 Canaanite tribes left, the Girgashites, and they went into Africa. And from the oral Torah tradition, that they also, because they did not want to get into conflict with the nation of Israel, they in fact brought the blessings of Israel into the land of Africa, although Africa, of course, was a blessed land already, as all lands are blessed by the Most High. There's no doubt about that. So, Alan, here we see Dawkins criticizing openly the outright depiction of the written Torah, portrayal of the destruction of the Canaanites. But in fact, according to the oral Torah tradition, they were offered an option to avoid war. Even with one's most fiercest enemies, according to Torah principles, one can offer peace with the hope that this will avoid a conflict. Any comments on this?
Well, it just shows the hypocrisy of Dawkins in what he writes about Israel. You know, he ignores the British history of them doing the exact same thing, people pointed out, his family was directly involved. They lived there. They were part of the system that was committing the atrocities. So I just find his slurs against Israel just really pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. I just, before I turn to Dennis, I just want to mention here that his own family, as you bring down, Alan, his own family was an important part of the system of British imperialism, committing acts far worse than he condemns the Israelites for doing. In light of the British rule in Kenya, which Dawkins' own family played an important part, it certainly puts an Enlightenment twist on Dawkins' statements in the blank delusion, such as the majority of us don't cause needless suffering. We don't cheat, don't kill, don't commit incest, don't do things to others that we wouldn't wish not done to us. Which is, of course, this is exactly what the Canaanites did. They cheated, killed, committed sexual perversions. They're involved in children's sacrifice, worshiping women as prostitute goddesses. So the answer to Dawkins' question, how then do we decide what is right and what is wrong, can only be understood in the context of Dawkins' own astonishing ignorance of the Torah. My purpose has been to demonstrate that we, and this includes most religious people, as a matter of fact, don't get our morals from Scripture. If we did, we would strictly observe the Sabbath and think it was just and proper to execute anyone who chose not to. And that's quoting from page 290 of the Dawkins Delusion. But, however, you concluded, Alan, here, and then we'll turn to Dennis for some commentary. If we look closely at the morality demonstrated by the philosophers of the Enlightenment, as well as the societies such as the British and French that nurtured them, we can agree with Dawkins on that point. They certainly did not get their morals from the Torah, meaning Dawkins and the British and French Enlightenment movements. Dawkins obviously did not get his morality from the Torah, since he evidently supports the sort of hedonism and violence that doomed the Canaanites, which I guess that also included their human sacrifice and idolatry. Dennis?
Yes, throughout history we have humans that when they get together and they're in charge of something, they flex power. They have power to flex over people. But what happens in a lot of cases is they put their morality in their back pocket and they bring out the word expediency. In other words, we have to get rid of these problems that are bothering us. And it usually has to do with people because they don't agree with us. So therefore, we have to move them on or get rid of them or help them pass. In other words, that's justification for getting them out of the way and even killing them. So what happens, yes, they'll use disinformation. They'll pick out any little reason to convince other people that the government, especially the country called Great Britain, great was because they owned so much of the world, so therefore they were flexing whatever they wanted to flex. And when that happens, it's the government who comes up with these ideas, politicians included, as to where the morality is. They don't go back as to where morality was written down, explained, and taught and hoped that people would understand, because they're coming up with a certain amount of expediency. They can't be bothered with the justification or looking for justice in anything. They want expediency and quickly do things. Well, we all know that's when the world becomes very, very messy. And I think Alan has brought this point out in many instances, where people who they're not true to what they say they do, because what they do is immoral.
True. Now I'd like to end on a more positive note, quoting from Alan's book at page 433, Mitzvahs Applicable to Noahide Law. And we'll read the following. It's basically a quarter of the paragraph, and hopefully in future programmings, with the help of the Most High, we're going to continue to go from where we left off last time, or today I should say, and also splice together with the back part of the book to make it very synergistic in terms of the overall picture, not just the trees of the negative Western influence, and also fuse it with the ancient eternal teachings which preceded what we as Jews received at Mount Sinai almost 3,328 years ago. Here we go. The far removal of robbery from among people is of benefit to all, and the human intelligence is a trustworthy witness to this. There is no great length of laws about it, as all of its content is clarified in the writ. I guess he meant scripture. It is enforced everywhere at every time for both man and woman. All humankind too is duty bound by it, since it is the branch of precept against, or the commandment about robbery, do not steal, which is one of the seven universal precepts in which the world were commanded to keep. Now make no mistake, in this reckoning of the seven precepts, or the seven commandments for the descendants of Noah, which is all human beings in this present time as well, which is known as mentioned in the Talmud, for in truth, these seven are in the nature of main categories, and they contain many details. And one of those details which spring out of it is from actually from chapter 20, verse 2, in the book of Shemos, or Exodus, is to believe in the existence of Creator. So, Alan, I think that this is our focus now for future programs with the help of the Most High, is to fuse together your criticisms of the Western civilization's attack on the Torah, fused with what the Torah has to offer, should hopefully stem the tide of future criticisms about Torah and the lifestyles that are being lived by, say, Jewish people and more of the nations who want to embrace Torah lifestyles and integrate it, and not see it as a contradiction to whatever country they're living in with their laws and their statutes and their ordinances.
Well, this is the beautiful thing about the Noahide law. It is so flexible. It is not to be as strict or as precise as Jewish law. It is to follow it closely, but it is also to incorporate each nation, each culture's own uniqueness into it. And, you know, teaching people how to get along despite their differences.
Yes. Dennis?
Well, the laws were written so that people would understand what morality is. You got to be careful of making it too flexible. Because if people say, oh, I only tell white lies, how many white lies do they have to tell before it becomes a bigger lie? So we cannot allow people to decide for themselves on a moral basis. They must adhere to our basic principles, because that's the foundation of everything. If we allow too many exceptions, the foundation takes a beating.
There is an absolute morality. Exactly.
Yes. Dennis, the thing that while Alan is talking about flexibility, it's a flexibility within the structure of definite instructions of how to conduct oneself. So just like, for instance, to believe in there's a God, that means many things to many different people. And some people might take it in the right direction, some might take it in the wrong direction. But if they start to learn the Torah instructions, like for the teachings of Rambam and other great commentators, then hopefully the flexibility will come out of knowledge and not just using the pure human intellect that we saw, which led to all the paradoxes and the oxymorons and the unfortunate tragedies which the British of the 20th century, for the last 200 years, what the British have brought into the human family experience, and as well as the Nazis of the last century. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both for coming on the program today. We're going to sign off now with some music, In the Now by David Dohm. We'll help our brother, our good brother from England, help us get back home to realize our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Our divine image will help us get out in scrimmage. And blessed souls, you can be good. You've got to do good because the Teva Tov Lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good. The Creator, who is the source of all good, is allowing you to live in this world. So go ahead and do some good. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.